This week's episode of Undisclosed is brought to you by Stamps.com. With the holidays almost here, you don't have time to go to the post office. It's going to be packed with everyone mailing holiday gifts and packages. So use Stamps.com instead. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer. Sign up for Stamps.com and use the promo code Undisclosed for this special offer. You get a four-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Go to Stamps.com. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in undisclosed. Stamps.com, enter undisclosed. This week's episode is also brought to you by Audible.com. Audible has over 180,000 audiobook and spoken word audio products. Now, I know last week a lot of our listeners were feeling some really serious withdrawal because me, Susan, and Colin took a break for the Thanksgiving holidays and we did not have an episode last week. In times like these of serious need and withdrawal, I highly recommend you go to audible.com and check out one of their amazing selections. Now, if you like Undisclosed, I'm going to guess you like true crime. Audible has 900 true crime books. And one of the ones I recently started checking out is Devil in the White City, which is the true and really fascinating account of a serial killer at large at the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago. If this is not a story you're familiar with, believe me, you want to check it out. Now, Audible is offering our listeners a free 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/undisclosed and browse the over 180,000 audio programs. You can download a title for free and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/undisclosed. That's audible.com/undisclosed and get started today. And finally, this week's episode of Undisclosed is also brought to you by the Texas Tech University School of Law. Now, many of our listeners have tweeted at us and sent us messages that they feel inspired to pursue a career in the law. So if you're interested in Undisclosed and you're thinking about law school, you should really consider Texas Tech. This year, the law school offered a criminal law seminar based on Serial and Undisclosed. And I actually had an opportunity to speak to their faculty and students, and they shared some great insights on Adnan's case. Texas Tech has 7 live client clinics, including a capital defense clinic. The school's advocacy program is highly regarded, and Texas Tech teams have won 36 national championships. It's a school that believes in giving back and in making sure that its students are ready to practice law. They are now accepting applications for fall 2016 and will waive the application fee for those referred by this sponsorship announcement. To learn more, visit www.law.ttu.edu/undisclosed. Once again, that's www.law.ttu.edu/undisclosed. Hi, and welcome to the 16th episode of Undisclosed, The State versus Adnan Syed. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and national security fellow, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. And I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Volkov Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs at The View from LL2. And Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor of the Evidence Prof blog. Now, after a year of covering this case, looking at it from every conceivable angle, there's one thing no one really thinks about much anymore, and that's the state's case. Because we know that it makes no sense, that the timeline is impossible, and that the events they claimed happened that day never actually did. But the state's case is still important today for two reasons. Remember, it's what Gutierrez should have torn to bits, but failed at miserably, which actually leads to many potential bases for ineffective assistance counsel claims. And then, of course, there's this, that despite almost everything about the state's case having been disproven or at least really strongly challenged, they still actually stand by their story to this day.
Which means it's important for the upcoming PCR hearing, because that's the version of events the state ran with and the events that Gutierrez was operating under, and the series of events that are relevant for evaluating possible alibi testimony, like Asia's testimony, and why she would have been important to bring to trial.
So let's start with the state's opening statements, and let's look specifically right now at how the state framed the motive in this case.
Here's Prosecutor Kevin Urich describing the state's theory of the case in his opening statement. Hayes saw that the relationship was not good for the defendant, and because she truly loved him, she let him go. The defendant, however, had a different reaction. In order to have this relationship, he had to live a lie. He had to lie to his parents, he'd had to lie to his religious friends. He was living a lie, denying to them that he was engaging in the activities that was forbidden in their culture. This is a great sacrifice. It was a double life for him. He was leading a lie, and when it ended, that's all he had left was the lie that he had been leading. He became enraged. He felt betrayed that his honor had been besmirched, and he became very angry, and he set out to kill Haman Lee. When Kevin Urich spoke to The Intercept in December of 2014, it was a very different version of the case he laid out. He said it was a run-of-the-mill domestic violence case, but this really reflects what the state was trying to establish, that this was a crime based upon religious motivations, based upon a high school student, unlike other students, who is leading this double life. And I mean, really, Rabia, it's I think, an unfair characterization of what was going on in this case.
I mean, basically what the state was saying was that if you're going to really look at this argument, is that this is a teenager who, because he was lying to his family, was leading some kind of nefarious double life. And I always argue that this is not just particular to Muslim teenagers or to teenagers that come from religious families. This is how teenagers operate, including my own teenager, who I have caught, you know, doing things she knows she shouldn't be doing. But the way it's already been framed is that Adnan is being set up as something that is like a very much an other. Like, what he is doing is not natural and not normal for a teenager to do. This will feed into later ideas that he's manipulative and he might be a little psychopathic. And those things are important because, I mean, that theme carries all the way to the sentencing. And I think very early on, and especially because Adnan was never able to, he never testified, the jury never heard him speak once, that very early on the prosecution was able to just characterize him like that, and it stuck.
So in addition to motive, the state introduced its main evidence in this case, or its almost only evidence, Jay. Here's how they describe what Jay would be telling them. Now you're going to hear a lot of evidence about how this happened. The more significant facts will be among these. You're going to hear how on the evening of the 12th of January, the defendant called Jay Wilds. Now, Jay Wilds was a high school student at Woodlawn too, but he's not among the bright and gifted. He lives with his mom, who's very poor. He's had to work most of his own life. And remember, when you hear about Jay Wilds and you hear him, remember that this is a person who the defendant, seated here, chose to use to put into effect his murder of his girlfriend. You may not like Jay Wilds. There may be things about him that you do not like, but remember, ask yourself when you hear these things, what was it about this individual that made him susceptible to being used and manipulated by this defendant? As I say, Jay Wilds had to work to support himself. He wasn't from a wealthy family, a well-to-do family. He doesn't have a lot of money for clothes to dress well. He had to take the jobs that he could. He worked at a pawn shop one time. He sells marijuana on the side. He takes the jobs that he can. But you'll hear that when he sells marijuana, he's primarily doing it to try to please these people around him. So that was Urich's opening argument about Jay. In other words, hint, 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 Adnan paid Jay to do it. But Urich keeps on playing this remember why Adnan can manipulate Jay card over and over again in his opening, like he says later on. And you're going to hear from Jay, and he's going to explain to you what he did and why. And when you do, when you watch him, all I ask is that you keep asking yourself, what is there about this individual that made him capable of being manipulated and used by this individual seated here? So Urich points out repeatedly that Adnan was in the magnet program, but that Jay was not among the bright and gifted. Urich is literally telling the jury that Jay was a simpleton living in poverty who was desperate to do anything for money. Just a nice-hearted guy who was too dumb and kind to even charge friends for weed, who will work at a porn store so he can afford clothes, but he'll help bury a body because he needs the cash. And he's also telling the jury, Jay is just too dumb to tell a coherent story. So yeah, it's going to seem a bit weird at points, but you know, he's not among the bright and gifted.
You know, I wrote about this a long time ago, I think early on, a serial was ongoing about how I think Yorick was pretty brilliant at how he just really brilliantly tapped into, like, you know, what he knew the jury also, like, how they would perceive these people, even, like, in their racial and ethnic kind of stereotypes, like, playing up to that. When he says specifically, all I ask is you keep asking yourself, what is there about this individual? I mean, we're talking about a Baltimore City jury that was mostly a black jury and a young black man who is going to come across as very vulnerable. And he's absolutely pointing to, I mean, what is it about this individual? You know, he's poor. He doesn't do as well in school. You know, he's got a single mom. And definitely, of course, he's also black. He's black like the jury, you know, like most of the jury. I mean, he was pretty good at, like, you know, reading what would resonate with the jury. And to this day, I'm astonished that he kind of tapped into those things so well. But I also wonder, I mean, to this day, he also says things like, you know, you work with the witnesses you have. So I wonder to what extent it was him just crafting a story and to what extent it was that he actually believes it. Maybe he really believed that this is who Jay was.
He knew Jay was lying. He knew. He admits he knew Jay was lying. He just says that he felt confident he knew why Jay was lying and it didn't concern him.
And he also has said that he didn't think the lies were important. I mean, that goes back to the Intercept interview where Yurik's talking about a material lie versus an immaterial lie. And for Yurik, things as big as where the murder took place aren't material, but he is willing to wave away the problems with that. And as both of you were noting, it's sort of, he insulates Jay as a witness at the very start. And I think, Robbie, you noted in a very smart way where it's sort of like Eminem in that final rap battle in 8 Mile where it's you lay out all the problems and flaws ahead of time and say, like, what can you do to me now? It's everything's out there, all the warts, it's been presented. Now you're going to hear the story, but, you know, it's Teflon. You can't get anything to stick to this particular witness for the prosecution.
He made the facts not matter. Here are the roles. Here's why some things won't add up, but it doesn't matter because the bigger truth is still true.
All that matters is Jay says that Adnan did it. The details don't matter so much. You have someone here. Why would he lie to you as a jury and say he took part in a murder or at least the aftermath if he didn't? And that's what the jury bought.
Well, he laid out the roles, that this is who Adnan is and this is who Jay is and this is what the relationship was like. And then he does move on to somewhat of a narrative of what happened on January 13th. So Yurik goes on to say, in fact, he did pick up Jay Wilds, he meaning Adnan. They went to the mall. They're driving around. The defendant says, you know what? I'm going to kill Hay today. Jay Wilds. What's he talking about? The defendant says, I want you to take my cell phone. I want you to take my car. Well, Jay Wilds, who has no car, is quite willing to take it. He takes the car. He takes the defendant's cell phone. He goes over to his friend's house. Well, first they go out and buy marijuana. You'll see that they went into the downtown. We know that from one of the cell sites, which was on 714 Poplar Grove Street. He and the defendant went to buy marijuana, then he took the defendant back to school and dropped him off at school.
Now, according to Yurik, this was a plan that was in motion from the day before, if not earlier. Yurik also told the jury that Adnan had called Jay on the 12th, the night before, to ask what Jay would be doing the next day and to ask if they could go shopping together. So the next morning at 10:45, Adnan calls Jay. They're going to go on that shopping trip because everyone knows that high school dudes love to skip school to go to the mall. So Yurik says that Jay and Adnan go and buy weed after the trip to the mall. He's talking about the 1241, 1243 calls, the ones that ping on L652A, I believe, which is near Poplar Grove, which is a drug strip. And Yurik says this was so they could buy some weed before going back to school. But this doesn't make any sense because no one's ever said this happened. This is not part of any story in any version of any universe where Jay has ever told the cops anything. As far as I can tell, Yurik's just trying to explain the cell records based on, well, there's a ping here, this must mean this. But besides which, it doesn't even fit the greater story here because if they went and bought weed at noon, then why the heck do Jay and Anand spend the afternoon after Hay is dead driving around looking for weed? They clearly know where to buy weed. They did it earlier, so why can't they find it later in the day? Or why do they even need more weed?
And I'll just say that, you know, Yurik, having been experienced in other trials, probably knows at this point that these details are not going to stick with the jury. They're not going to matter. He's just laying out an overall narrative. And even people who do a lot of public speaking know that people remember the most what's said at the beginning, what's said at the end, all the little details and these things, like, it's very rare for, unless they're taking notes or something, for them to pay such close attention. It would only come down to whether or not the defense is able to point these discrepancies out.
Yeah, the only thing I can think is that they place such primary importance on the cell phone record and the pings that, in this case, he's trying to give the appearance that all these events map neatly onto that call log and the record of the pings. They don't, but sort of that would, I guess, be the reason why, Robbie, as you note, it wouldn't usually make sense, but maybe he's trying to create that corroboration even though it doesn't exist.
And besides which, even ignoring the cell phone stuff, just his version of Jay's story is nonsensical because everyone knows, there can't be anyone still listening at this point who actually thinks that Anon springs this, I'm going to kill Hay, I'm going to call you, need a ride story. And Jay's just like, oh, okay. Yeah, that didn't happen. Everyone knows it didn't happen. But it's less insane than everything else that Yerrick's got, so he goes with it anyway.
And then here's Yerrick laying out the timeline of when the state argues to the jury that this murder occurred. According to Yerrick, at the end of the school day around 2:15, Aisha Pittman, who is a friend of the defendant, Ms. Lee, and all this, sees the defendant talking to Haley after the last class. She leaves. One Inez Butler, who is a teacher there who runs a little concession stand for the athletic department, talks briefly to Haley about 2:15, 2:20 when she's leaving school. She picks up a soda and a bag of snacks. She's going to come back and pay for them. That's her usual practice. She has a cousin who she picks up after school. She's leaving to pick up that relative who's, elementary student, take that person, then come back to school. So basically, this is the timeline of Hay leaving school soon after 2:20 p.m. It's why Asia McLean is such an important alibi witness on appeal. And as we'll discuss in more detail later, it's completely wrong in the sense that we know Inez Butler ties her memory to the wrestling match that did not occur on January 13th. And obviously, this forms the narrative of the 2:36 Best Buy call. And even here at the very beginning of trial, we now know the narrative presented by the state bears no tangible relationship to what actually happened on the 13th.
And the state very firmly says it's going with a 2:36 phone call timeline. It says Jay receives a call then. Come meet me at Best Buy. Well, he gets there, Yerrick says. The defendant has Haley's car. Defendant says, I've done it. He pops open the trunk of the car. Jay Wild sees the body of Heyman Lee in the trunk dead. At that point, the defendant says, help me, follow me. He takes the victim's car to the I-70 park and ride, parks it there, gets in his car with Jay Wild's, and the two of them alternatively make various phone calls. There's a lot of problems here, which we've gone over in detail. Sarah went over in detail. And of course, in Jay's Intercept interview, he totally throws this whole story under the bus. But even aside from all the factual issues, it doesn't even make sense narratively. Because why is Anon going to murder someone, put their body in a trunk in broad daylight in a public area, make a call from a payphone, and then hang around that place, hang around in Murderville, until Jay finally gets his butt over there to pick him up? No, everyone knows after a crime, you get the heck out of there. Besides, there's no point to even have Jay pick him up from the Best Buy. He stole his Hayes car. If there was gonna be a come and get me call, the only place for it would be the I-70 park and ride. The only reason Best Buy exists is because they want to have a dramatic location for the reveal and some way to tie Anon to their presumed murder spot. So then we have Yerrick going through the time of various calls, about the 3:21 call to Jen, calls to Nisha, calls to Phil, calls to Patrick. And then Yerrick says, after the drop of the car, this is at the park and ride, the defendant wants to get some marijuana, wants to get high. He and Jay are riding around. Jay has some contacts. He's trying to see who's home, who's got marijuana. He calls up Patrick. That person's not home. Makes another call to Jen. So again, the state is firmly committed to this whole, hey, step of 2:36. And they spend the next hour looking for weed, even though they bought weed with no hassle from the Poplar Road Strip just a couple hours before.
Yerrick then goes on to insert
Christy, or as a lot of people have come to know her, not her real name, Kathy, into the story, and says that, Jay takes Adnan back to school, drops him off for a bit for track practice, comes back, gets him, and they go over to Christy's house. While they're there, they get a few incoming calls. And by this time, the family of Haman Lee is looking for her, and so her brother calls Adnan, and then Adnan also speaks to the police. The prosecutor goes on to say that Adnan gets these calls, he panics, and then he says, we need to get out of here, we need to do something with the body, and they leave. This is what the prosecutor said. Well, Jay Wiles will tell you that at that time, the defendant became frantic. What do we do? What do we do? We've got to get rid of the body, he says. Come with me. They go over to Jay Wiles' home. They get two shovels. Then they head to Lincoln Park. And you'll see that at 6:59, there's a call made on the defendant's cell phone to one of the defendant's best friends, one Yasser Ali. Immediately after that, there's a call made to Jennifer Pusateri. And then there are two incoming calls at 7:09 and 7:16 at cell site 7689B, which is located on a cell tower at 2121 Windsor Garden Lane. And you're going to see a map from the AT&T wireless records showing 689C being this light brown area, and that cell site is a cell site that covers Lincoln Park. And that those two calls at 7:09 and 7:16 come out of, actually, it's 698B, pardon me, covers Lincoln Park, and that this cell site covers Lincoln Park and not much else. So here you've got Yurik basically starting to imply that Yasser, Adnan's friend, is also part of the conspiracy, and maybe Jen too.
I mean, that's the only way I can read it, is that, I mean, he's saying Adnan became frantic. What do we do? And then they make calls to Yasser and Jen. I mean, that kind of implies that, I mean, there's a connection there.
And they come back to it in closing argument, too, where I think they note the coincidence of the anonymous call mentioning Yasser and then the 6:59 call made to him, implying that he was either involved or there was a confession to him. So it certainly becomes more overt as the trial progresses.
And I guess as Yurik, he's thinking he has to explain those calls because in real life, people don't just pause their murder plans to make social calls to friends. And then we got Yurik's discussion of the cell phone evidence. I mean, it's kind of a mess because, well, first of all, the actual exhibit they're using at trial, they have not aligned it right. So, in fact, L689B, the Lincoln Park Tower, the way they have it there before the jury, it doesn't even cover the burial site. And it also is an extremely large area compared to other cell sectors. So when Yurik's saying it only covers Lincoln Park, well, no, that's not true based on their own maps. What it's also not true is a matter of the technology. One thing about Abe's interview that I will say is that, the way he put it, engineers wouldn't be so dumb as to build a tower that covered only a park where no one lived. That tower would have covered areas beyond Lincoln Park, and Yurik's implication that only a phone in Lincoln Park would call in there has no basis in reality, or in their own exhibits.
Next, here's Yurik basically explaining his spying theory to the jury about Jay maybe being inconsistent on minor points, but sticking to his guns as to the core of his story. According to Yurik, now you're going to hear that consistently, Jay has always given the same story about what the defendant did where, as to the defendant's actions. Consistently, he tells Jennifer a consistent story. He tells the police a consistent story about the defendant. He tells consistently the defendant's involvement, the defendant's actions on that day. He has never wavered on that point. And you're going to hear how the cell phone records corroborate that activity, both by who is making the call or they're alternating the cell sites, verify the locations that they're at, corroborates that. Now, basically, that's not at all consistent with what is presented at trial and what we know about the case. What the defendant did where? We know that Jay has varied the trunk pop and murder location 5, 6, 7, 8 times. We know that his story versus Jen's story, they don't match up pretty much at any point during the day, whether it be the daytime visit to Jen's house, the calls in the 7 o'clock hour, what happened, whether the drop-off was at the mall, Jay's house, how they disposed of the clothes, etc. And in terms of the cell phone records corroborating Jay, we've gone over this any number of times. The cell phone records, the pings, etc., in the vast majority of cases, do not match up with Jay, either in terms of timing or location. So Eurica is certainly trying to package this up nicely, but when you get into the actual testimony and the records, this consistency sort of evaporates. It doesn't exist at all.
And here's my favorite part of Yorick's opening, and I genuinely think it's a really good little strategy he pulled. It's how he sets up Jay's, well, lack of consistency, because despite all of Yorick's claims about Jay consistently being consistent, it's clear that he's not. So Yorick's going to have to explain why Jay is all over the place. So he preps the jury and tells them that, yeah, there are going to be inconsistencies, but they mean nothing, and here's why. Here's what Yorick said. You're going to hear that Jay Wilds has given several statements. And you're going to hear that between the first statement and the second statement, he changed certain things. In fact, he changed three things. You're going to hear first that he said that when the calls came in from Officer Adcock and Young Lee, he and Anon were at a McDonald's restaurant. Then in the second statement, he's honest, and he says they were at Christie's. He's going to tell you that he didn't want to get Christie involved in this. He was trying to keep her out, so he didn't want to admit they were at her house. Secondly, he left out Jen Pusateri, and he'll tell you that he did so because he didn't want to get her involved. And the third thing that he's going to tell you is that he initially told the police that when he met the defendant, it was not at the Best Buy, he was at a place on Edmondson Avenue. So you're going to hear it. Yes, there were three things that he changed there, but you're going to hear that he's been completely consistent as to the defendant's activities throughout. So yeah, it's a nice little story and makes the jury think, well, he got three things wrong, or he lied about three things, but we know why he lied. But it just isn't true. There is so much more that Jay changed. Huge details, crucial details. Details that could have gotten Jay executed if he was tried in Baltimore County. But Yorick, of course, leaves those out. But just to recap a few of them, other things that Jay changed, just between the first statement and the second. Whether he planned the murder with Anon 4 to 5 days in advance. Whether he told Jen about the murder twice before it happened. Whether he knew or not how Anon had gotten into Hay's car. Patapsco Park, enough said. Whether he helped with burying the body. Where he was at basically any point at all when any call was made or received. Where he and Anon bought drugs. What he told Jen. I mean, Yorick's telling the jury that Jay was consistently consistent with Jen, but Jen says that Jay told her he had no idea where the body was buried. Or no idea where various things had occurred. So obviously he's not being consistent to her. Besides, the reasons for Jay's lies that Yorick's putting forward, they don't make sense either. Like Jen. He involved Jen from the start and her brother by making them his alibi for the time of the murder. Plus there's the fact that in the second interview, the cops asked Jay why he lied about meeting Jen at Westview Mall, which I've never been able to figure out because, as far as I know, Jay's never actually said that happened. But Jay confirms that, yeah, he did tell the cops that he met Jen at Westview Mall during that first interview, but that he lied about it for some reason. So now we have Jay admitting to lying about things that implicated Jen. And then there's Kathy. Again, it's the whole didn't want to involve her thing. Jay says that Christie's dad was a cop, so he didn't want to cause trouble there. But, well, her dad wasn't even a cop in the first place. And besides, if he doesn't want to involve Christie, why is he telling the cops that he confessed to her boyfriend when he didn't? Again, the story that Jay was lying to keep friends out of trouble is illogical because Jay loves to lie in ways that get his friends in trouble. And then we have the Best Buy thing. Obviously, during his second interview, Jay claims that he lied about Best Buy because he was concerned about the cameras there. But at trial, this changes. Jay testifies that he told Jen that the cameras didn't concern him. And he says he lied because he didn't want to embarrass Hay's memory by admitting that she and Anon had sex in Best Buy parking lot. That lie right there, I mean, to me, it shows blatant coaching. There's no way Jay got that lie himself. He's never used it before. It sounds to me like the kind of excuse making a lawyer would like bend over backwards to try and come up with. Because for whatever reason Jay lied about the Best Buy, it was not that.
Yeah, and if we're to take Jay at his word in his 2014 Intercept interview, he is lying. as to these reasons, because the reason he lied in his 2014 interview was to protect his grandmother, because the trip hop actually took place outside her house. So was he lying in 2014? Was he lying back in 2000? Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, Yurik is trying to say he lied as to three things at first. Here are the reasons. And we know, at least according to Jay, that that's incorrect. And as you say, Susan, he could be lying both times. He could be lying one of the times. It's just so unclear with Jay. That's part of the huge problem in this case, is we don't know when he's lying and when he's not. And we don't know the reasons why he's lying or possibly telling the truth on certain things.
And I still think Yurik was, I mean, he pulled it off. So, you know, kudos to him. But I can't imagine taking that kind of gamble at opening arguments by ignoring some of Jay's more blatant misrepresentations and contradictions and just hoping they never really come out effectively. They didn't, so, you know, it worked out. But, like, the fact that Jay tells the cops that he told Jen twice about the murder before it occurred, and that Jen was like, okay, whatever, let's go back to video games. Let's not bother to try and stop this girl we know from getting killed.
My big question is, we know we read from Douglas Colbert's affidavit about what happened after the first trial, and in it he mentions representatives from the state talking to the jurors about why they were leaning toward not guilty. I'm guessing, I wouldn't be surprised at all if when the state talked to those jurors at the first trial, they had the very issues that Yurik is prefacing in the opening statement, because he realizes, okay, here were the weaknesses in our case, the first trial. Here's what we need to fix for the second trial, and these are the exact things that he is basically caulking over in this opening statement, because he knows they are problem areas for the state's case.
So in the state's case, they had a few moving parts, but probably the big three components were their version of Hayes' timeline, Jay's timeline, and the forensic evidence. Let's start with the state's version of Hayes' timeline.
And here's what the prosecutor said at the closing. We know that class ended at 2:15 that day. And remember back to Aisha's testimony. The defendant was talking to Haley at that point in time, and Inez Butler sees Hayes as she rushes out of school, grabs her snack, and heads out the door. Ladies and gentlemen, she's dead within 20 minutes. 2:36 p.m., the defendant calls Jay Wilds, come and get me at Best Buy. So that's pretty much it. That's the entire timeline of Hayes' afternoon presented by the state. And I remember actually sitting there during that closing argument. And, you know, as this trial was ongoing, I lived in Virginia, so I couldn't be there all the time. And I was working and going to law school. And I think mostly I attended on like Fridays or something. I can't remember how I managed to once in a while pop in, but I was there for the closing. And that's when it really hit me, because that was their entire case, was those 20 minutes. And all I kept thinking was, did Gutierrez manage, during the time I wasn't there at least, you know, to account for those 20 minutes? And that's why, you know, after he was convicted, that was the first thing I asked Adnan, you know, about those 20 minutes.
You can tell, though, that they just didn't even care about what Hayes' timeline looked like, because they didn't. They never bothered to figure out basic details, like when exactly Hay typically showed up to pick up her cousin. Yurik says before 3, and then we have her brother saying like 3:15, and then we have earlier during interviews, the detective saying like, oh, 3:20. So, you know, no big deal. We can figure that out later. We don't need to really know what her timeline was like on the day she disappeared. And then we've got Yurik saying, oh, she was going to go back to school. Well, according to Inez, yes, but she doesn't seem to know what's going on, because she doesn't even name the wrestling match that Yurik thinks was going on that day. She names some school that's out over on the east side of Baltimore County.
Chesapeake.
Chesapeake, yeah. And instead, Yurik's going this whole, she was supposed to go to Randallstown near Owings Mills Mall that day. But they also don't even bother to figure out like when she was working, because they go with the idea that she was supposed to work from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m., but as far as I can tell, there's no evidence that that's actually when she's supposed to work that day. Based on past time cards, that's not a shift she usually worked. It seems like she usually worked from about 5:30 to 9:30. And when Don testifies, he corrects the attorneys and says, no, she was starting work at 5 p.m. that day. But again, just details. Who cares where the murder victim was supposed to be at a certain time?
Well, Inez says that the wrestling match is at 6:30 p.m., which, if you're paying attention to what's going on at trial, doesn't seem to make sense. Well, she's going to a wrestling match at 6:30. She's supposed to be at LensCrafters at 6. She's always been known to show up for work. So what exactly was supposedly going on this afternoon, which obviously, Susan, as you found, there was no wrestling match, which makes things fit together a lot better. But the jurors at trial had no idea about that. Let's really dig into what was presented to the jury versus what we now know. Pretty much the prosecution presented what I think was a fairly compelling, convincing argument to the jury. When you look at this closing argument, they have Krista, the good friend of Hay and Adnan. She testifies at trial that she learned early in the morning about Adnan asking Hay for a ride after school. We know that Aisha testified at trial that she saw Adnan and Hay talking at the end of school, and the presumption is, because no one asked her what the content of that conversation was, that they were talking and on their way to go to Hay's car for Adnan to get that ride. We have Inez Butler Hendricks testifying that about 2:15, 2:20, so right after the conversation with Aisha, she sees Hay as she's leaving in a hurry to drive away from school with the intent of coming back later for the wrestling match. Now, if you're looking at it as a jury, you say, well, he asked for a ride. Aisha sees them talking. She leaves soon thereafter. The presumption you're going to have is he got that ride. And because that was the last anyone saw of her, it's reasonable to conclude that he was her killer at some point during this ride. But as we've shown through the course of this podcast, there are serious flaws with this. One flaw is that Krista has told us that she talked to Aisha on January 13th later in the day, and that the content of that conversation when Aisha saw Hay and Adnan together was that Hay was turning Adnan down for a ride. She had said that something else came up, and that's consistent with Becky, who we'll discuss in the defense case. We know that Inez has the wrong day because there was no wrestling match. And we know with regard to Asia McLean that she is a strong alibi witness who says she saw Adnan at the library up until 2:40 p.m., whereas the prosecution's claiming that this Best Buy call happened at 2:36. So, you know, when you're comparing things between what the jury saw versus what we know pretty concretely now, it goes from a story where it's pretty open and shut that Adnan did it to, you know, now we have 2-3 witnesses saying she turned him down for a ride. The last person to see Hay alive likely didn't see her on the 13th. She had the wrong day. And upon scrutiny, the entire core of the state's argument falls apart.
In addition to Krista, they also have Aisha testify. Aisha was a good friend of Hay's, and they had her there to talk about some general school stuff, but mostly she was there for the I'm going to kill note. So this note was written very end of October, or maybe first couple days of November, after Adnan and Hay's second to last breakup. And on one page, you have the note from Hay to Adnan saying, you've been so cold since 7:45 a.m., it's now about 10 a.m., and they're in health class. And on the front and then on the back of that note, Adnan and Aisha started carrying on a conversation referencing things they learn in health class, like I statements, where you say I statements to avoid hurting someone's feelings. So they joke about that on the first page and turn over to the back, and that's where you get the I'm going to kill blank. So, of course, the prosecution's like, here's his confession, months in advance, even before they broke up for good. He is planning to kill her. But as Aisha confirms on cross, she and Adnan were joking around. I mean, it was just, as Gutierrez puts it, sort of a little riff about whether or not Hay, your best friend, his ex-girlfriend, might be pregnant. But it's not just about Hay being pregnant. They're joking, in the crass way of teenagers, about Hay needing an abortion. It's not totally out of the blue, because they're in health class, and that day, as you can tell from the conversation, they're learning about human reproduction. It seems like on the overhead projector, they've got a list of symptoms of pregnancy. And based on Anand's uterus-like doodle, it seems like they've got some human anatomy being displayed too. But here's the thing that has always made the I'm going to kill note seem such an irrelevant bit of trivia. Just look at the note itself. So you have in the very first line of this lined piece of paper, and the blue pen, which is what Anand was writing, "I'm going to kill." Then there's a blank space, and then Aisha writes in pencil, "Here's the thing." It's hard to read. It says, like, "Hay is pregnant and having mood swings." There's a space. Anand writes, "You should ask her to make a list of all her symptoms and compare it with list on the overhead." And it goes on from there. There's a space. Aisha responds, space, Anand writes, and so on. So just the way it's laid out, it looks like it's part of a single conversation. There's no reason that the note would have nicely started three lines down with Aisha saying, "Here's the thing." Because the line itself is just a response. I mean, for me anyway, I don't know about you guys, but if I saw like a note that said, "Here's the thing, hey, it's pregnant," you'd assume there was some kind of communication before that.
Yeah, so basically then, that is the state's narrative. It's the state's timeline of these key events that happen from 2:15 to 2:36. And so we have witnesses like Aisha and Inez covering that. Interestingly enough, though, there was a key witness who very much disrupted this timeline and this narrative, leading to the state having to essentially try to write her out of the narrative. And that's Debbie, the good friend of both Anand and Hay. In large part, Debbie's testimony is reading the diary of Hay, and that's, as we noted before, something that easily could have been excluded, but Gutierrez actually stipulated to its admission. But more importantly, Debbie testifies about the events of January 13th, and specifically, she testifies twice that she remembers seeing Hay near the school gym at about 3 o'clock p.m. She says she recalls having a short conversation with Hay, but that Hay was in a rush and had to go. During direct examination, she says she doesn't recall where Hay had to go, but on cross-examination, this is actually one of Gutierrez's good things that she did at trial. She gets Debbie to acknowledge that she had told Detective O'Shea that when she saw Hay by the gym, she was going to see Don. And, of course, what we know is, and as we've discussed in the podcast before, Debbie says she hadn't met Don before January 13th, but when Hay disappeared, she surreptitiously emailed him trying to find out where she was because she thought that Don might have something to do with her disappearance. Eventually, though, according to Debbie at trial, after a 7-hour phone conversation with Don, she's convinced he's no longer involved. She becomes convinced that Anand is the one who led to Hay's death, and Don and she become friends. So importantly, Debbie does testify about seeing Hay at 3, which very much disrupts the state's timeline. What she doesn't do, and we discussed this very early in the podcast, is we know that in both her police interview in March and at the first trial, she says she recalls seeing Adnan at the guidance counselor's office at 2:45 p.m. on January 13th. But again, despite remembering this fact at the first trial, just about a month before her testimony at trial 2, she says she has no recollection of saying she saw Anand outside the guidance counselor's office at 2:45, and Gutierrez, in this case, drops the ball. She does nothing to impeach Debbie or to refresh her recollection based upon her saying that she saw Anand at 2:45. Robbie and Susan, as you might imagine, based upon them saying that Hay is dead by 2:36, the state, by the time it gets to closing argument, does not include Debbie in the timeline. You can imagine sort of doubly why that's bad. One, it contradicts the state's timeline of Hay being dead by 2:36. But two, Debbie quite openly says, "I saw Hay and she was on her way to go see Don," which means that as a result, not only does the state have to write her out of the timeline, they have to be sure that they can convince the jury that Don was not the one who is guilty of the murder of Hay.
And then we have Don. The state calls him to the stand, and obviously, after Debbie's testimony, there's a huge potential problem here. If the jury believes Debbie, then Debbie's the last person to see Hay alive, and she saw her leaving school in a hurry to see Don. The state, however, front-ended Debbie's testimony with Don's own testimony about his alibi. Don testified, well, at this trial, that he started dating Hay on January 1st. Although in the previous trial, he said that they'd been dating already. They just didn't have an official date until the 1st. He said he'd seen Anand when he would come by LensCrafters to see Hay, and that some point after he and Hay started dating, he saw Anand again when Anand came by to see Hay's car at LensCrafters because due to the snow, Hay had had a small accident. And according to Don, he and Hay were already an item at that point because it was the old boyfriend checking out the new boyfriend, which means that Don's first trial testimony, when he says they dated before January, is more accurate than the second trial.
In Hay's own diary, she says that their first date was on the New Year.
Yeah, she does. But it seems like Don's aware of that at this point. But he, before, in the first trial, is pretty clear that they dated before that, and he didn't think that there was a reason to believe it'd be later. So it's not clear why Hay wrote that. I mean, maybe it was just that was the first official date. But there had been clearly some kind of dating, if not boyfriend-girlfriend relationship before then.
They could have been what young people now call talking.
Yeah. I mean, this doesn't bother me. Like, that's
right.
That's how relationships happen at that age. So
sure, sure.
I think whatever Hay meant by first date, they were clearly already, you know, had been talking. So regardless of when they became official, they'd been dating in December when Anand came and saw him. And according to Don, Anand was pleasant. Anand and Hay seemed to still be friends. They didn't seem to have any issues. And there was nothing that stood out to Don about this. And in Serial, you might recall that Don said Yurik yelled at him after his testimony. In fact, after both trials, yelled at him because he didn't make Anand seem creepy enough. And with regard to January 13th, Don testified that he'd been filling in at the Hunt Valley LensCrafters from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Yurik corroborated that testimony with Don's time card. Don says that he got a call from his lab manager at the Owings Mills store at 7 p.m. after he'd gotten home from his shift, indicating that Hay hadn't shown up at work and that he needed to call the store back. This is a bit different from his statement to O'Shea, in which he said that he called Owings Mills after being told to do so by his father, but Gutierrez doesn't notice this difference, and it's never clear what the sequence of events was there. Gutierrez also asked Don whether he's aware that someone from Woodlawn High School had told the police that Hay said she was on her way to see Don after she left school on the 13th. But despite his seven-hour conversation with Debbie on the phone, the person who told the cops this, Don says that he was not aware of this fact. Gutierrez then asked Don what he told the police about what his plans were with Hay on the 13th, and Don says he doesn't know, doesn't remember. Although Gutierrez fails to use a statement to show that it contradicts what he said earlier, in which he said that Hay was supposed to call him and they were supposed to hang out. And here's another frustrating loose end from Gutierrez's interrogation of Don. This is from Cross. Question. And you worked at Hunt Valley, and that was unusual because normally you worked at Owings Mills all day during the daytime of January 13th, correct? Answer. Could you restate that, please? Question. You worked at Hunt Valley that day all day on the 13th, didn't you? As you can see, and as Gutierrez does quite frequently, she doesn't rephrase her confusing question. She just abandons it and moves on. So, we still don't have an answer to this question today. Was it unusual for Don to fill in at the Hunt Valley store?
Yeah, so again, this becomes a matter of what we knew back then as a jury versus what we know now. And, you know, it's not entirely clear, but what the jury was told was, while Debbie said that Hay was on her way to see Don on January 13th, he has this pretty ironclad alibi. He was filling at the Hunt Valley store. What the jury didn't know was the manager at the Hunt Valley LensCrafters was Don's mother. The manager at the Owings Mills LensCrafter was the live-in partner of Don's mom. We can't say anything conclusive, but certainly both on Susan's blog and on this podcast and others, there have been discussions about possible irregularities with Don's time cards that we're still trying to sort out. You know, but again, none of this is presented to the jury. What's also not presented is any type of forensic evidence from Don. He says on cross-examination, he was never asked to give fingerprints, blood, saliva, or hair. So, you know, some of the hairs found on Hay's body that didn't belong to either Anand or Hay were never tested against him. The fingerprints in the car, like the ones found on the rearview mirror, were never tested against his fingerprints. You know, we don't know. Frankly, I tend to think that Debbie has the wrong day, but maybe she has the right day. Maybe she's combining events from different days. But, you know, certainly there is an existing version of the narrative out there where Debbie, the very first person interviewed in the wake of his disappearance from Woodlawn, who recalls seeing her on the 13th, says, I saw her leaving school to go see Don, and we have possible questions about whether Don's alibi, in fact, holds water. So, you know, these are things we all wish were investigated back in 1999 and 2000. They weren't, and it remains a loose end that we can't quite wrap up at this point in time.
So I have a procedural question for either one of you. Now, it seems that, you know, Gutierrez is clearly aware that, you know, the Don's samples were not tested again. They weren't even taken, forget being tested. So the question is that unless the state itself wants to get those kinds of samples from somebody, I mean, like, is the defense just kind of at a loss? Can defense counsel themselves ask for those things to be, samples be taken and tested?
They couldn't at this point, and it's also just not relevant to a Don's case. I mean, the police did a terrible job in investigating, and it is what it is.
It's also tough because, you know, Don's own story is that he was with Hay on the night of the 12th. So, you know, if hairs of his were found on Hay's body or other physical evidence in the car, see, that's what's tough is you can get testing of a viable alternate suspect. And certainly in this case, Gutierrez was trying to claim that Don was a viable alternate suspect. But I just don't know what physical evidence in this case could have been used to show he was the perpetrator because, you know, obviously the state could have just claimed he was the boyfriend, he'd been in her car, he was with her the night before, so obviously he's going to have physical evidence on her person in the car. So that's sort of the difficulty there. Really, to me, came down to the time cards. I mean, private right. investigator for the defense tried to investigate Don. He was told he has an ironclad alibi, he has these time cards, so that's where this alternate suspect theory sort of lives and dies, I think. If there, in fact, are problems with the time cards, it's huge, and it's something that needs to be investigated. And if there's not problems with it, you can pretty much write Don off as an alternate suspect. And again, it just seems, as with so many things in this case, there just wasn't sufficient investigation done.
I did find it interesting, though, that when the defense investigator tried to go to LensCrafters to confirm Don's alibi, he got a manager that day that was not related to Don, and she wouldn't answer his questions. She said she couldn't help him and told him to call the police instead. And then we have Yasser. The state called him to testify as well. Why call him at all? Well, it's a little unclear. They don't seem to get much headway out of him because he doesn't recall any phone calls from Anon during the relevant time period. He says that Non never confessed, for sure. I never told him anything relevant. But I think a big part of why Yasser was there was because it helped the honor besmirch narrative that Yurik was going for. Even his questions are just, well, they're not PC, I guess is the best way to put it. Yurik asked Yasser, what is your understanding of the penalty within a country ruled by Islamic law for premarital sex? The court sustains an objection and says that you have not laid a foundation that the witness knows what the penalty is in the country, so with no foundation, can't ask. Yurik says to Yasser, what is your understanding of the penalty within the Islamic religion for premarital sex? Answer, that is not allowed. Question, what would the penalty be for it? Answer, we actually say that should be taken care of by God. It's not for us to discuss or, you know, chastise. Question, have you studied countries ruled by Islamic laws? Gutierrez objects, court sustains it. I mean, come on. I mean, it's clear what he's trying to get. He doesn't get it, but he wanted some, it's punished by death, I'm sure.
It doesn't apply to anybody. That's not even the rule. I mean, if you actually want to talk about those laws, it doesn't apply, but it certainly doesn't apply like this. And there's not at all any distinction between men and women on these issues. But the point is, none of that matters. Again, I keep going to, you know, it doesn't matter. These are just raising red flags, characterizing people a certain way, demonizing people, and facts don't matter. And you know what's really frustrating to me on this issue specifically is that you had this huge Muslim community. Christina Gutierrez had the resources if she wanted to pull in a Islamic expert, a scholar, to talk about this and be like, this is crap. This is ridiculous. This is not, it doesn't even work like that if you're going to even go there, on top of which we're not living in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, but it does show that Yurik was pushing it part of his narrative as in countries ruled by Islamic law, it's okay to kill women or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's also the argument, you know, the cultural consultant made in her memo months prior.
So that's the state's timeline for what happened to Hay that day, where she was, when she was last seen. The second part of their case, after going to the Woodlawn students, the teachers, and also some of the cops, involved Jay's side of the day, and specifically Jay, Kathy, and Jen's testimonies. According to Jay, he first hears from Anon the day before the 13th, on the 12th, and Anon just asks him what he's up to. And Jay says, oh, I was out partying for my birthday, that's it. And Anon asks him what he's going to do the next day, and Jay's like, I don't know, just chill. Nothing significant happens there, unlike Urich's opening statements, in which he claims that Anon asked Jay to take him to the mall the next day. Jay says they had no plans, they just chatted, and that was it. The next call is the first call during the daytime of the 13th, the 10:45 a.m. call. According to Jay, Anon calls, says, what's up? And Jay tells Anon that he needs to go to the mall to get Stephanie a birthday present. And Anon says, cool, I'll give you a lift. I'll be there in an hour to pick you up. So Jay says he gets a shower, gets dressed, 11:45, Anon comes to his door, knocks on the door, and they go to security mall. He says they're there for about an hour, 15 minutes, so according to Jay, 11:45 to 1 p.m. This does contradict his statements to the police in his interviews when he says that Anon's back at school by, you know, 12 o'clock lunchtime. But in this version of the story, Jay and Anon go to the mall for an hour and 15 minutes, have a deep bro-to-bro conversation about relationships. And according to Jay, Anon says he was hurt by Hay breaking up with him, but he didn't sense any anger. And that Anon said Hay made him mad and he was going to kill that bitch. I'm not sure how Jay can also say he didn't sense any anger combined with those statements, but it's Jay, I guess. Somehow, after an hour and 15 minutes, Jay is still not done shopping. So after they leave the mall, Jay asks to borrow the car again so that he can finish shopping for Stephanie. This guy's very diligent about buying birthday presents. And Anon says, sure, you can borrow the car if you pick me up later. Again, according to Jay's story, there's no plan whatsoever for Jay to have the car. It just kind of worked out that way. So, according to Jay, around 1 p.m., if they were at the mall for an hour, he drives Anon back to school. And Jay specifically states, as he always does, he dropped Anon off at the back of the school. So, the more southern entrance along Woodlawn Drive, which I can't shake a feeling is significant because it's so repetitive the way the cops always bring this point up. And they're always so careful to specify that in these initial trips, the ones that everyone agrees happened, Jay was doing the picking up and dropping off in the back parking lot. As one Woodlawn student wrote to me, they believed that there were cameras that were facing that entrance, stationed at the security Nissan right next door to the high school. If that's the case, that could explain why there's always this insistence about the back parking lot, because there was a video there, and the cops knew when Anon's car had gone back to Woodlawn High School.
I also spoke to the man who owns the strip mall plaza where there's a 7-Eleven right across the street, so basically on the same street, also facing that entrance, about whether or not they had cameras in 1999, and he said that they in fact did not. They had a camera inside the store, but nothing outside the store at the time. And he's not sure, but he's pretty sure that they did have street cameras at the time there. But he also says that no police, as far as he recalls, came to ask about any of the cameras. He also referred me to the man who was leasing the 7-Eleven store from him, the space, and I spoke to him as well, and he basically confirmed that. He said that they had no visits from any police looking for camera footage.
So now is time for another time warp. Get used to it. There's a lot of them in this testimony. So even though we have Anon being dropped off back at school at 1 p.m., we're now going back to 12:07 p.m. when there's an outgoing call to Jen. According to Jay, after he and Anon shop for an hour at 11:45, they go to Woodlawn High School, he drops Anon off, and as he's leaving Woodlawn at 12, he calls Jen to find out if she's home. She's not, but her brother is, so he goes there to play video games with him. Then we go to the 12:43 call, which is an incoming call, which the tower is the one over by the Poplar Grove Strip. According to Jay, This call comes in when he's at Jen's house before he and Mark go to a mall shop. It's Anon. Anon asks Jay where he is, and Jay says he's at Jen's playing video games. Then we go to the next call, which is at 12:41 p.m., so 2 minutes before the last call. Yeah, don't try and put logic on it. It's not going to work. This call's an outgoing call to Jen, and Jay says that 2 minutes before they leave Jen's house, he calls Jen's house to find out if Jen's there or something. They kind of just do some hand-waving and try and get past it because it's really rough. And Jay clearly has no idea what he's talking about.
Then there is the all-important 2:36 p.m. call where, according to the testimony, Adon calls, he has a conversation with Jay about the phone being off and about picking him up at 3:45 p.m. But in his earlier police statements, Jay also says that at 3:15 p.m., Adnan made another call to pester him. So Jay's testimony is kind of muddled, and this could be the call that he's talking about, that it was Jen calling. He mentions that she does do that, but it also could be the landline call that he's talking about.
So in his earlier police statements, Jay tells the cops that there's three calls from Adnan that day where he's just checking in on Jay, make sure everything's cool, and those were presumably the 12:43, the 2:36 and 2:15 p.m. calls, none of which, Jay is clear, are the come and get me calls. They're just these, hey, is the phone on calls. At trial, it's hard to tell for sure what Jay is saying, but it seems like he's basically getting at the same deal. But either way, he is clear. There is no come and get me call until after 3:45 p.m. Like in earlier statements, Jay says he left Jen's house before the come and get me call came in, which again was due to a typo in the detective's records, which made them think that phone call couldn't have happened at Jen's. And then we get to the come and get me call. According to Trial Jay, there's no the bitch is dead, come and get me, I'm at Best Buy. It's just, I'm at Best Buy, come pick me up, dude. But there's no time with this call. I mean, the next incoming call after 3:45 is 4:27 p.m. It's 3 minutes long, and it's the only call left that can be the come-and-get-me call, according to Jay's story. But for reasons we'll get into later, this can't be right either. So with every other call, when Jay talks about a call being made or received, Urich stops him and asks him to ID on their giant blow-up phone record exhibit which call it is. Not with this one. Urich doesn't want to draw any attention to it. He just lets Jay talk. So Jay is claiming the come and get me at Best Buy thing. I mean, he doesn't give a time. There's no time it can be. It's a call that can't be explained and has no evidence to support its existence. And it's the linchpin of the state's case.
Yes, yeah, so then moving on, whenever the Best Buy call is, we have Jay responding to it by driving to the Best Buy, expecting Adnan to show him some weed. He sees Adnan standing outside at the external payphone at Best Buy, slowly follows Adnan as they walk around to the Sentra with Adnan wearing red gloves. And basically, at this point, we have the trunk pop, and Jay says when this happens, he is holding a cigarette, but he's so startled when he sees Hay in the trunk that he drops the cigarette. And at that point, Adnan tells Jay to follow him, and Jay, according to his own testimony, is so dismayed and confused that he agrees to go along. Adnan, though, doesn't say a word. He simply, when they arrive at the park and ride, parks the car. He starts rummaging through the trunk. He moves some objects from the back seat to the trunk. And this is all going on, apparently, while the trunk is open and Hay's body is completely visible to anyone in the parking ride, which sort of makes no sense. But at that point, after rummaging through the trunk and the passenger compartment, Adnan gets in Jay's car, says absolutely nothing about the murder. Instead, he simply says, hey, want to get some weed? Yes, Yeah, so then we go from the park and ride. Again, Jay's story at trial is he doesn't get the come and get me call until after 3:45 p.m., but now we're going to go back in time again from 3:45 and however long after that it takes to get to the park and ride. We're back to 3:21 p.m., and under this version of the narrative and timeline, they call Jen from Cook's Road to see if Patrick's home.
So the 3:21 call, according to Jay, happens... Well, the timeline makes no sense. I'm not even going to try. But he does say that he and Anon are driving down Cook's Lane towards Patrick's house at the time, which I find interesting because a call made from there could be expected to originate on L689, either B or C, the Lincoln Park Tower. So according to Jay's own statements, calls could have been made on Anon's phone that pinged the Lincoln Park Tower for completely innocent reasons, or mostly innocent reasons involving going to buy weed like they usually do. Which I wish Gutierrez had harped on and pointed out that, just according to Jay, there are totally innocent reasons to expect Anon's phone to be in that area. But she doesn't pick up on it. So then we get to the Nisha call at 3:32. Again, this is before Jay says he ever left Jen's house. And it's also after they've called Patrick, which is at 3:59. So they do some, like, time jujitsu. I don't know. Somehow they get to North Forest Park at a time between two future events. And even though Anon has said, like, nothing this whole time, literally he gets in the car with Jay, says, let's get some weed. They try and find weed, they can't. The very next thing Anon says to Jay is, after he calls Nisha up and then hands the phone to Jay and says, hey, talk to her.
Yeah, and that takes us to the... what's been known as the Nisha call. I prefer to refer to it as the 3:32 call from a non-cell phone to Nisha because it's not the call that Nisha testifies to. It's not the call that Jay testifies to. Whatever that call is, it is not this call that Jay is saying takes place at the Forest Park golf course. It's not the call that Nisha describes when Anon is visiting Jay at the adult video store where he didn't start working until the end of January. But basically, the Nisha calls at 3:32, which is, again, as we know in the timeline, Jay is saying the come and get me call is until after 3:45 p.m., so there's no way that Anon is there for this call. But according to Jay, they are up in Forest Park. They're trying to score some weed. And that's the point, which actually after, which we'll discuss in a second, the Phil and Patrick calls, which come after the Nisha call. He claims after a call to Phil and an unsuccessful call to Patrick, that's when the call to Nisha is made. And so we have this call at 3:32. It can't be what Jay is describing. If we have any faith whatsoever in cell tower pings, it's not geographically correct. Timing-wise, it's not correct for a few reasons. But, you know, this is the call where he says, Adnan calls up the girl from Silver Spring, Nisha, puts me on the line, and we talk for a few minutes. It is the only time that I've ever talked to her.
And I find it hilarious the Nisha call has been considered at times like the most damning evidence against Adnan. Because it's a confusing mess of crazy. But if this is the most damning evidence against Anon, that shows you how weak and hypothetical the state's whole case is. Going on from 3:32 p.m., we go forward in time according to the cell records, but back in time according to Jay, to 3:48 and 3:59, when we have calls to two of Jay's friends, Phil and Patrick. Jay says that Phil's a long-term friend of his, does not offer any explanation why he decides to call Phil after he's driving around in a murder car with a murderer, and then calls Patrick looking for weed, and then Patrick's not there. I can't even try and explain what this timeline is because there's no way to do it in an even remotely coherent manner. But then going forward again with the phone logs, we go to 4:12 p.m. This time, according to Jay, in a never-before-heard story, he says that this call was to Jen to ask if Christy was home, not her real name, Kathy. Not sure why he wouldn't just call Christy, but either way, it for sure doesn't sound like a guy who's worried about dragging his friends into a murder plot.
This is where Jay says that he drives Anon back to track practice and Anon busts out with the all-knowing is Allah after apparently having killed somebody and smoked pot during Ramadan. He says that Adnan was concerned about forensics, that he was concerned that there could be some DNA evidence of his on her body, and also he wanted to be seen at track practice. And he also testifies that Adnan told him that during the commission of the crime that Hay struggled and she kicked and broke off the turn signal. But then Jay also mentions that he asked Adnan to stop so he can buy a blunt, and Adnan, who is late for his alibi and not wanting to smoke weed, still agrees. And then at 4:27, there's a call that Jay says is from Adnan's mother, because he assumes it's from Adnan's mother because he's speaking in Arabic or something. And then after he drops Adnan off at track practice, Jay goes to Christie's. Again, not her real name, Kathy's. But of course he didn't. He's lying, because Jay has to tell a lot of lies to get through this story. And a lot of them still involve with friends and murders when they weren't involved. So then the question is, why does Jay even have Adnan's car at this point? Why doesn't he ask to go home? Why has he asked to borrow it? And there's also the question of the fact that later on, we'll hear that Christie only testifies to Jay having come by once that day. But here, Jay is saying that it's happened twice.
It strikes me how much of a puppet Jay seems in his versions of events. He really does seem like this golem that just does what he's told, never talks back, never talks about anything. He's just a silent, hovering observer who occasionally drives a car around, but never interacts with Adnan, just takes his orders and goes. He doesn't even question Adnan. He has just no agency whatsoever in any part of the story.
That might have also occurred to the jury, but, Yura can already preface that by showing this power dynamic, showing this guy who's maybe not so bright. You know, I mean, like, he's already covered his base with that. It's okay if it doesn't make sense. This guy doesn't act the way any other person might, because he is somehow powerless in this situation.
I mean, I think that's what Yurik was intending, and I think it worked out for him. But for me, it's hard to reconcile, because Jay doesn't come across like this at trial. He comes across as, I mean, frankly, he's running circles around Gutierrez, and he seems like a guy who's in control, who's making decisions in terms of how he interacts with others in the court, in terms of how he interacts with Gutierrez. He frequently stands up for himself against her. He repeatedly, turns to the judge and says, "Can you ask her to stop yelling at me?" So if he's the kind of guy who can happily stand up to attorneys in a courtroom while under intense cross-examination for days on end, why was he a ghost when Adnan was telling him to help him cover up a murder?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it all comes back to Colbert's affidavit again. You might recall, and we discussed it, how the jurors were saying after the first mistrial, we would have voted not guilty, but beyond that, they were wondering why Jay wasn't the one on trial for murder. And it seems to me, comparing trial one versus trial two, Jay, according to the interrogation, looks more of an active participant in the events at trial one. And I think consciously, Yurik decided to make him more passive, almost as you say, Susan, a ghost who is reactive as opposed to proactive. And I think he was successful. And that is, I mean, overall, I think the key thing here is the prosecution learned its lessons from trial one. They were losing. They saw what the problems were. They created makeshift solutions. Gutierrez, in between trials, she was in Puerto Rico. She was handling death penalty cases down there. People were fleeing her firm as if it were the Titanic. And I don't think she really did anything between trials. By her own admission, she says that at the start of trial two, she was out of the country, she was traveling, she was sick. And as a result, the state, did a nice job of covering these holes. And they did it by basically, making Jay this person who's just along for the ride and isn't actually doing anything himself.
So after 4:27 p.m., Adnan goes to track, Jay goes to Christie's. 4:58 p.m., Adnan calls Jay and says, "I'm done with track, come get me." So he's been there for all of 28 minutes, but, solid alibi, right? So Jay goes back to school, gets Adnan, they go back to Christie's. According to Jay, Adnan has a tiny bit of weed, first time he smokes that day. And then Jay says there were three phone calls. The first was Hay's parents, asking if he knew where Hay was. The second, at 6:09, was Hay's cousin. Presumably, he means Hay's brother, but that Hay's cousin slash brother was calling the wrong number. And then at 6:24, we have the cop call from Officer Adcock. According to Jay, Adnan answers the phone, isn't acting totally weird, but while on the phone with the cop, he gets up, walks out the door, and motions at Jay to follow him. Jay, for no possible reason that makes any sense at all, decides to follow him out because even though he was safely with some friends, his friends, in an apartment, he thinks it's a good idea to go get back in the car with a guy who just randomly killed his girlfriend. Again, there's no reason whatsoever to explain why Jay would have just been compelled to follow Anand because he motions, "Come with me," as he's walking out the door without explanation. And then Jay also adds an interesting detail in that as they get downstairs from Kathy's apartment, Anand takes his red gloves out of his pocket and throws them in a dumpster. Not sure why, given that they're still going to be driving around and Anand still has lots of murder-related items to touch, but at this point, the red gloves are out of the story.
Yeah, and Susan, I think that's part of the state's case, too, is they realize that Adnan's fingerprints are not on Hayes' clothes or body, but his fingerprints are in the car, and so they're trying to explain, well, he strangled her while he had the gloves on, but then these fingerprints in the car, they're not from the dozens of times that Adnan was in the car when they were dating. It was from him moving the car after her death. So it's again, they're sort of trying to, the state is trying to make everything make sense. And in doing so, it makes everything nonsensical, except for the fact that, you know, it was sold to this jury and the defense put up really little to no resistance to point out the absurdities of some of these claims that are being made.
I like how Anand has no gloves and never tries to wipe anything down, according to Jay. And yet he manages to leave no prints on anything remotely connected to the murder, but manages to touch all these innocuous items in the car, like an envelope that was shoved under some of like the carpet lining in the car from like months ago, from October. But, you know, he never touches like a car door handle or the steering wheel or like a turn signal. But he touches Hayes' insurance card because clearly during a murder, that's a priority to check out.
If I'm remembering correctly, Susan, also that envelope has fingerprints that are not Adnan's and they're not Hayes'.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of non-identified prints, so.
Yeah, it's one of those things, again, that the fingerprints, which we'll discuss in more detail later, it's at best meaningless. At most, it might point to someone else who's unidentified being in that car.
So after they leave Kathy's together, because Jay is compelled to do whatever Anand says from some kind of dark Muslim magic, Adnan drives Jay home, and then Adnan tells Jay, "You have to help me cover up this murder some more because I know what you do. I know about your casual pot dealing to friends. Now you have no choice but to help bury a body in the woods." And Jay agrees, not just because of the pot dealing, minor pot dealing, but because of Grandma. Because, you know, taking your grandmother's shovels to use in the murder cover-up, that's not going to get her in trouble. So yeah, I mean, his claim and the one Yurik tries to use to be like, oh, it makes sense that Jay would help, is that, oh, the whole grandma thing. But it doesn't make sense. There's no reason at all. The fact that grandma had some minor amounts of pot that was clearly not hers and probably didn't exist given that Jay and Anand had such trouble trying to find weed earlier that day. No, that's not a reasonable explanation. It's not a true explanation. Yeah, and it probably goes back to Yurik's opening about the hint, Jay would do anything for money, because Yurik has to know too. If you try and peel this back a bit, it makes no sense. Anyway, Jay also testifies that he doesn't go to the cops because the cops had beaten him up last week. And he assumes that if he told the cops that he knew where a body was, the cops would blame him. Which I find interesting because Jay must be referring to some period of time between January 27th and February 2nd, if he's saying he'd gotten beaten up the week before. That was January 27th. I mean, it's Jay, so it's hard to, you know, try and impose order where there is none, but based on what Jay is saying and his timeline that links this to a week after he got beaten up by the cops, that's right around February 1st and February 1st phone call to Crime Stoppers. Plus all those references to Jay's video store, which, again, he started working at last couple days of January. And to the extent we can date the things Jay's talking about, they all seem to come from very end January, very beginning of February, and not January 13th.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because for a lot of these things, you could at least see there's some grain of truth there. Again, he could be going beyond that and lying. But yeah, I mean, Susan, this thing about the cops beating him up is pretty intriguing to me because we've discussed Crime Stoppers and the possible reward being the motivation. If there's any truth to this, and in fact the cops were beating up Jay and it has some type of connection to this case, that's huge because that certainly could be another explanation for what's going on here and how Jay comes to become involved in this case.
So yeah, they get the shovels, they go to the park and ride. Then Anand has Jay go wait at the McDonald's on security. Not sure why, it doesn't make any sense, but Jay's stuck there for a while, like 20 minutes, while Anand does something. Then they drive back to Patapsco, or according to one interview they do. He's kind of vague at trial and just says they'd kind of drive up and down and back again. After a long time, they end up finally in Lincoln Park. And at this point, after several interviews, Jay can actually kind of describe the place where all this happens. And his story isn't quite as disconnected from reality. However, it's still totally illogical. First, ignoring the phone logs, because they also don't track with the way time normally progresses, just the sequence of events is pretty hectic. Jay says that he and Anand both pull up, him in his car, Anand in his car, on Briarcliff, which is a little road up kind of outside of the valley that is Lincoln Park, up a little windy road, around a corner, and they get there, they park Hay's car, and then he and Anand drive back down the road, turn to Franklin Town, pull over on the side of the road. They both get out, they both start digging a hole, then they both get back in the car, they take the shovels with them. So they dug the hole, shovels go back in the car, they drive back up, around the corner, back up again to Briarcliff, park the car, Anand gets out, gets into Hay's car, drives down again, around the corner, onto Franklin Town, pulls over. Jay is not there. He's still sitting in the car in Briarcliff. Then a long while later, after presumably Anand has put Hay's body into the grave, Anand drives back to where Jay is. Anand gets out of Hay's car, gets into his own car with Jay. They drive down again around the corner, pull up again by the Jersey walls, get the shovels back out of the car, and go out. Jay sits on a log and smokes while Anand throws dirt on the body. Now, this story seems ridiculous, but it actually serves a very important purpose. This convoluted version of events that involves three separate trips of driving down and back again is necessary to explain why there's no dirt from shovels in Hay's car. Because to make their case work and to explain why there's no evidence of dirt in Hay's car, the shovels have to enter and leave the burial site in Anand's car, but the body has to get there via Hay's car, which only works if you have three separate trips. So it makes no sense someone would dig a hole, put shovels back in the car, then put something in the hole, then take shovels out of the car to cover it up again, because presumably you know you need the shovels for both tasks. But what the story accomplishes is to avoid any inconvenient questions about why Anand threw a shovel into the back of Hay's car, and yet no dirt was found there when the cops found it.
They didn't even test Hay's car for soil, right? I mean, they pulled the lining from Anand's trunk and vacuumed samples, and as far as I recall, I don't think any of that was done with Hay's car. Maybe it was done and they found nothing.
They did take soil samples from Hay's car. They were logged into evidence, but they were never actually used in comparison testing. They did test samples from Anand's house and belongings, but there were no matches there anyway. So that's the sequence of events involving the burial. Here's what Jay says about the actual phone calls during this time period. The first call at 7 o'clock occurs while Anand is down the hill again, around the corner, up against the Jersey walls, putting Hay's body in the grave. And that's when Jay pages Jen, because Jay was supposed to hang out with Jen at 7 o'clock, and he has to tell her he's going to be late. This is impossible because there's a 659 call to Yasser, which means that Jay and Anand had to have been together when these calls were made for the state's theory to work. Unless, of course, the Yasser call really was a misdial, like Jay seems to describe. But it also doesn't work because then for the next call at 7:09 p.m., we have to go back in time. So it's 9 minutes later by the phone records and about 15 minutes earlier by Jay's story. Because while Jay and Anand are digging the hole initially, the very first step in this process, Jin calls back to Anand's phone. Anand answers, says, Jay's busy, he'll call you later when he's ready to go. And that's that. I mean, I could try and map this out and diagram it, but it still wouldn't make sense, so I'll stop beating this dead horse now. Anyway, the point is, Jay's chronology, it progresses differently according to the time stamps on the phone records and according to his sequences of events. And then there's 716 call, again, while they're digging a hole, and Jay says he doesn't know who it is, but it's someone that's not speaking English, and there's a lot of suggestion from the prosecution that this is actually Yasser returning a call. Of course, we have Yasser's phone records, so we know it's not him.
So then, according to Jay, him and Anand drive around in circles for a while, with Jay following. Remember, they're in different cars. They are still somehow communicating, but they are in different cars. And after they park, Jay finally tells Anand to take him home. Jay says that Anand tells him, killing her kind of makes me feel better, but then again, kind of not, which is a really odd thing to say. But then we have that at 8:04, Jay pages Jen from the mall, and then Jay pages Jen from his house a minute later. So according to Jay, which is different than what Jen says, Jen actually comes and picks him up from his house. Jen says that she picks him up from the mall. But nonetheless, Jay tells her about the murder. They stop to get blunts at Superfresh, and he throws away his clothes while Jen is buying the blunts. And that explains maybe why she actually doesn't see him throwing away the clothing. At some point, they go to Stephanie's that night because it is her birthday, and after all of this very busy day, he still needs to say happy birthday to his girlfriend. But apparently he makes her meet him at the curb so he can give her the stuff, meaning the birthday presents. But according to Stephanie, she actually didn't get birthday gifts that day. That's what she told the private investigator, and she wasn't home anyways. And then Jay says that at the end of the night, they go to Christie's, meaning not her new real name, Kathy. And that is apparently where he does not confess to Jeff this time in this testimony.
So that's the phone records according to Jay. You've got calls from 10:45 a.m. to 8:05 p.m. And Jay was there for all but the first one, the one that Anand made from Woodlawn. Now, if the cell phone records corroborate Jay, as Yurik claims, you'd expect to see some, you know, not perfect connection between those calls and what Jay testified to. But you would think that you would see some kind of correlation there, that, you know, there was a visible relationship between where Jay says they were for each of these calls and what tower is actually showing up on the phone records. So is there? Well, no. Because if you're going by the state's theory of how the cell records work, then throughout the course of that day, there are exactly three calls which are not contradicted by the cell records. That's the 7:09 p.m. call while they're digging a hole in Lincoln Park, the 7:16 p.m. phone call while they're digging a hole in Lincoln Park, and the 8:04 p.m. call while Anand is driving Jay home. And I'm being generous to the last one because Jay doesn't actually specify where he was on Edmondson Avenue at the time of that phone call. So, you know, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. What he says doesn't contradict the phone records, and it could possibly be consistent with them. So sure. In all, exactly three calls match the cell records. So that's it. Those three calls match the records. For every other call, the cell records simply do not match what Jay testified to about where the phone was at the time those calls were made.
So we've heard from the state's primary witnesses, the ones that tie Adnan directly to the crime, Jay and Jen. The state has laid its foundation, and now it's going to build on it by calling witnesses primarily to do a couple of things. First, to build a story about the crime itself, through police witnesses and medical experts, and of course, the cell phone expert.
and more importantly, to build a narrative around who Adnan is as a person and what his relationship to Hay was like. To do that, the state will call a few people that knew both Adnan and Hay and would certainly carry weight with the jury, teachers and staff from Woodlawn High School. Remember, Adnan never testified at his trial. His attorney wouldn't allow it. So the only way the jury could figure out who he was and what he was like was through witness testimony. Next time on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Our production consultant is Rebecca Lavoy. She's a true crime author and hosts the podcast Crime Writers on Serial. Dennis Robinson is our producer. And you can find us online on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.